is Whatever is Whatever with Maya Hislop. I'm so excited about this week's episode. I got to talk to a comedian that is based in Washington, D.C., Kurt Mariah, originally from North Carolina, now doing the open mic circuit in D.C., very up and coming, been working for 2 years on their comedy. We got to talk about cooking, church, family, Christianity for a long, long time. We talked about blackness as a spiritual identity. So I'm really excited for everybody to get into this episode right now. But before you do that, or while you are listening, or after you listen, please go check us out on Facebook, Whatever's Whatever, like the page. Check us out on Twitter at WIWpod, or, and in addition to, go to our website, whateverswhatever.com, where you can find all of your listening needs met. So thanks so much for listening. Hope you enjoy. Hi!
Hey, how's it going?
Good. So the way I start is with these three survey questions. Can I have you state your full name?
My name is Kurt Mariah.
And do you have any religious affiliations?
No, I don't.
Did you grow up with any religious affiliations?
Yes, I grew up Southern Baptist. My mom made me go to church every Sunday.
Okay. Wait. And that's it. Okay. So I want to start actually with food. Okay. It's so funny that you, Kurt, cooked this amazing meal for me. Actually, I should mention we're outside in Columbia Heights, D.C. I usually record this inside. So this is exciting. Whatever is Whatever is on the road. But I noticed from your Instagram that you're really into cooking.
I am.
And you have, like, I've learned. You should, like, just describe the meal that you made, and it'll give a sense of how how into
okay,
cooking you are.
Well, we had pan-fried wild-caught salmon seasoned with Good Sense Farm umami spice, accompanied by a salad of...
Umami is just seaweed, right?
Umami is actually a flavor. It's like saying bitter or salty. Mm. But it's made by taking mushrooms and drying them and pulverizing them. And the mushrooms give it like a richness. So like umami is, it means just like richness or like savoriness. So that's the name of it. So my like, my sibling's company that I work for, it's called Good Sense Farm. There's a little plug. And we have umami spice, so. So that was what's on the salmon. And then the salad. And the salad was sage, thyme, mint, mustard greens, collard greens, live forevers, oregano, lamb's quarter, pigweed. And I made a dressing of fermented ginger, vinegar, and lemongrass oil.
Wow. And all of the greens come from your garden.
Yes. And dandelion also.
It was amazing. So when did you get into cooking? And yeah.
I've been cooking all my life. I mean, my mom's family is like amazing cooks. Like, and so it's always been a thing. I've always been like at my mom's elbow. Whatever I could do, I would do it. And so I just got serious about it probably like 2 years ago, because growing up, everybody in my family cooked, but to say you want to be a chef when you grow up is not a job that they think is a thing. So I went to undergrad, I did pre-med, which didn't make any sense, and I did all that stuff, and then I just got serious about the cooking thing like 2 years ago. So I've done a few events and you know, worked in a few restaurants and stuff.
Really?
Yeah.
So,
when did you start thinking, like, this is a job? This, because there's so much of, I feel like, family life or things we do on the regular that could be monetized.
Right.
I was just thinking about that with housework, actually. Like, I've been taking kind of a chill pill from work. Mm-hmm. And just, like, cleaning the house. Every day I kind of clean, like, another section.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I just realized, like, how it's so fulfilling. It's so mentally organizing. But it's work. Like,
oh, it's work.
It's
so
a lot
of
work.
Saying that I can pay you to come over and clean?
I don't think you'd like the level of cleaning I do. I do just the bare minimum. But for me, it's, like, a lot. Because what my roommate and I do is we, like, let the house kind of go till it's, like... Because I was scrubbing the floor in the kitchen. I was like, oh, this is what clean looks like. Like, it got really bad.
Yeah.
But we don't notice because it's just the everyday.
Gradual progression. That's how it happens with my room. I will have clothes on every surface and then take, like, 2 hours and clean it all out.
Yeah.
Like, on laundry day... It's the one day my room is actually clean, and then it's all downhill from there.
But I just thought about women who do housework, who are housewives or house workers,
mm-hmm.
and don't get paid or just do it because it's part of their routine or part of their life. And I feel like anybody who says it's not work has never done
it. Has never done it. And doesn't do it on the regular.
No.
Tell you,
oh, my
no,
gosh.
Definitely. Yeah. Funny story. I got into an argument with my dad. I live with my dad. And I said to him, so our doormat is probably like 25 years old. I remember when we bought it and I was a child. I was a small child. And it's worn, it's raggedy, and it doesn't have any, like, brush anymore, you know? So people track dirt inside. And he's like, oh, there's nothing wrong with it. And I said, as the only person who sweeps him up the floor, I feel like I have the authority on this. You wouldn't know. And it really made me angry because it's like, you don't think, you just see it as like either clean or dirty. And whatever happens in between has nothing to do with you. And it's just like, like, how could you think? And it's like, the reason why you don't do it is because you don't want to do it. Because you know it's not fun. So, you know, so.
Yeah. Although I do remember being a kid and my mom being so adamant about me cleaning my room. And I didn't understand it was my room. Like,
right.
She didn't have to be in it. So I didn't understand. I'm okay with how it is.
Right.
Why do you care?
Same thing.
But the public spaces, like, those need to be clean. Yeah.
Exactly. And the kitchen.
Yeah.
Gotta clean the
kitchen. Oh, yeah. So that's really interesting to me that, like, cooking is a part of kind of your family identity.
It definitely is.
Yeah.
Definitely is. And my family identity is starting to kind of morph a little bit. Or, like, I get... talking about monetizing those skills. So my siblings started a business where we grow mushrooms and raise bees for honey. And it's like...
I just made a shocked face in awe and admiration.
So for the cooking thing, for example, it's like I could... you know, get a job at a restaurant and, like, work my way up and break my body and work, you know, 50, 60 hours a week to prove myself to somebody above me and get the skills here and there and da-da-da-da-da and then become a chef, right? And this is the traditional way. But I was like, or I could do my own thing on my own terms. And do my own study and my own practice and make my own food and, you know, and get whatever certification I need to, like, do it legit. But, you know,
it's just like kind of a shift in
from the informal to the formal, back to the informal.
Right, kind of making the informal formal, or like elevating what is regarded as informal, you know, like prioritizing who is the authority over me. Somebody who I could work for, somebody who I don't even know, who could not, because I've experienced that. I've worked in restaurants and I have felt entirely taken advantage of, entirely disregarded. And I feel like, you know, I'm impatient. I don't want to chop onions for 2 months to prove to somebody, you know, that I can finally make gravy. Like, it doesn't work like that for me. And so
it worked like that for Julia Child.
Right? And that's totally fine. That's one way to do it, but I'm going to do it my way.
So speaking of authority, that's kind of a good, I mean, in my mind, a good segue to God.
Okay.
Because I think that translates into how at least I think about the church or churches or religion, is that we need something outside of ourselves to guide us, like, instruct us. And that's not something I fully believe in, although I think it's valuable. Okay. It has its merits for certain people. But I'm wondering, so I want to go back to you when you were, when your family was Southern Baptist or just getting into that, how you were raised in terms of religion.
It's funny because I just had a show, and the show was called Church Night, and it's
It's a comedy show?
Well, I did comedy. There was burlesque. There was all this other stuff, but it was a lampoon of church, you know, a very critical lampoon of church. And in my set, I talked about how the teachings I had experienced never seemed to jog with my real life experience. Mm-hmm. Like in the church, for example, men could be trustees, but women couldn't. But in the church, it was the women who were the most educated.
What's a trustee?
A trustee is somebody who, like, they count the money for the church. They do, like, financial and administrative stuff and have some other authority in some other way. And in my church, they all have penises, you know, which is a prerequisite. You know, it didn't make any sense. Or like, I've never been able to believe it, any of it. And I, for a large part of my life, I thought it was me. I thought, you know, and I talked about this in the set. It made me have like an active fear of death and dying, because I was like, if I don't believe and then I die, I'm gonna go to hell, so like I can't die yet. And I would tell myself, like, and then it kind of morphed into this strange like obsession with getting my head chopped off. Like my head could be chopped off at any moment, you know.
Wow.
A taut wire across the road while I'm bicycling.
That is so specific. I love that.
It's so specific, but it's like in a movie, it's just like getting your head chopped off is the ultimate in, like, you can't cure it. You can get shot and you can get shot and survive. You can get stabbed and survive, electrocuted, struck by lightning, bit by a shark, hit by a car, in a plane crash. But if you get your head chopped off, that's it.
You know? One and done.
So I'm talking about like Final Destination style. Like, I, to this day, I will step back from the curb if a large truck is coming down the street. You know, they hit a road sign, it bends, cut your head off. You know, it could happen. And this was my life for like a long time.
This is like your childhood.
Into like
recently.
Not recently, probably like 16, 17.
So you're in church till when? When do you stop going to church?
see. When I went to college, when I would come home. I think my mom stopped going too. I think she called herself like raising us right by making us go. And once we went off to college, it just kind of fizzled out for everybody.
Wow. Did she ever, was that ever discussed? Like, yeah, I just did that for y'all kind of thing?
Very recently. Only recently. Yeah. Like, this year. We had a discussion about it. And she told me some really interesting things about why she made us go to church. Mm. You know? So.
Any of those things you want to share? You don't have to.
I don't want to, I don't know what she wants people to know about her, but I did reveal, I came out to her as an atheist, and she was like, she did not criticize me at all, if I will say.
Right.
You know?
Was that surprising to you?
It was, and it's kind of like when your parent tells you that, maybe they're not a Christian either. It's a little scary because you're like, oh, you know, what if we're both wrong? You know, I can take responsibility for myself, right. But like my sibling has never believed. Like my sibling has been like a militant since way back, like 10. And I remember, or before then, and I remember being in church trying to be like a good little Christian girl, and my sibling next to me like, come on, get out of, like, rolling eyes, like, wow. Loud, very, you know, vocal about just like, this is bullshit and I hate it and everyone in here, you know? And so, you know, that kind of pulled me in that direction, and I guess it had an effect on my mom too.
Yeah. So, I really identify with that kind of hypocrisy angle you were talking about before. Like, why should it be that men are the leaders of the church? Women are often, especially in black churches, I don't know if it was a black church. Tend to be the sort of congregation, the followers. And there's, I have very, very smart Christian friends, so I'm always, like, referring to them. But I think there is, like...
I have very smart Christian friends, too, and I always just want to be like, why? Tell me, like, how... You know, I don't know. I'm not somebody who... Here's the thing. Here is the thing that is not fair, okay? When you say, hi, that's my neighbor. When you say to someone, oh, you should come to church, or, you know... Or I've had people say, oh, you'll start, but something is going to happen to you and bring you back. You know, are you, first of all, are you wishing something bad happens to me? You know, like, what? What if it doesn't? You know, something's going to happen to you. Or, like, this kind of, like, my parents, my dad, for example, you should come to church, or, like, you know, da 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 da. This is fine. But when I say to people, Jesus is not real, like, you know, are you sure the Bible is true? You know, when I say to people, this is aggressive behavior. This is like, you know, so I just often keep it to myself. But I do have smart Christian friends. And I just want to ask them, like, just like what, like, you know, give, let's lay out all the facts and let's just look at them.
Yeah.
You know,
I think getting into facts is tricky, it's right? So with faith.
You can't do it. You can't.
And somebody recently told me, somebody like Kierkegaard or somebody said, you can't reason yourself into faith. And I just, I've realized as soon as that person said that, I have been trying to do that. Mm-hmm. Or I've been, like, reasoning myself into it, reasoning myself out of it, kind of, like, going back and forth.
How do you identify?
I have no idea. I'm so... This is why I kind of wanted to start... Yeah, I guess agnostic is the closest.
That was me. I was agnostic. But I read something that was like, okay, if you're agnostic, and I was, some agnostic people are like, I don't know, I don't, you know, I don't know yes or no, so, you know, it's up in the air. They're like questioning agnostics. Some people are like, I don't know either way, and I don't think it matters. And that was me. So necessarily, for me, if it doesn't matter, then, you know, why believe it at all? You know,
right.
If you think there might be a God, but the God doesn't do anything, then there's no God, you know, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, so that I think, like, you going back to death is based in if you really think, like, when you die, it's over.
Right. Right.
Which atheists have to... I think most atheists have to kind of...
I don't think...
Oh, okay.
I'm not a... I don't know what kind of... Maybe I'm agnostic.
They're agnostic atheists. It's yeah, all labels.
Death is a different subject for me.
Let's get into it. Okay. I love talking about death. So I also started this because I finally kind of realized I am going to die. For real. Like, I finally kind of had... Terms. Yeah, I just...
Have you come to terms with it, or have
no.
you just realized?
I've just realized, and now I know that it's going to happen. Like, yes. It is a fact. And it's crazy to me that to me is such a sign of age, of like, oh, I've grown up. Because children don't know they're going to die. Like, yeah. Adults know they're going to die. And it's been a big shift. And for a while, I had a year of just fear. Straight up, like... I can't believe we're going to die. What does that mean? I'm so afraid of dying. I don't want to be afraid of dying. How do I embrace this? Or do I embrace this? Like, blah, blah, blah. And it's very much lessened now. I think day to day, I can't. It's such a big thing. It's hard for me. Because when I was in that period, I was like, how is everybody not thinking about
like,
this all the time?
Out.
Yes. And it's like, oh, right, because we can't. One.
Right.
And also, I was in that, it was a real kind of depression, but it was like an anxious depression, you know, it was just like, what's going on? I don't know. And I didn't, when I was in it, I was like, I'll never get out of this because I know I'm going to die now. And that's just true now. Like, I am a person who is afraid to die and I will be forever until I die. Like, that's who I am right now. But it took a year and now it's kind of that phase of it when it was that. Low is over. Mm-hmm. And I just realized, oh, it took time. So maybe death, or coming to terms with death, is just about time. Like, all of the people I know who are older are seeming to get more comfortable with the idea, somewhat. Like my middle-aged parents, for example. Mm. One of whom is religious, one of whom isn't. What made me scared is my grandma, who's 80-something, is definitely afraid. She's afraid of everything. But I know, like, she doesn't say it, but I know her husband died. When he died, it was like she didn't know he was gonna die. It was like she didn't know.
She hadn't
thought about it in a while, probably.
Yeah.
And that scared me, because I was like, I'm scared too. I don't want to be 80-something and scared still. His death was pretty... He had gotten cancer, a benign cancer, and then it was... He was pretty healthy for years and years and years. And then kind of, yeah, all of a sudden, he was 93. But it was pretty traumatic for her, because I really don't think she thought it was going to happen. He was so, you know, they were together for like 55 years. So that freaked me out.
Those are the kind of fears that I have at this point. Like, remember, I mean, if my head gets chopped off, you know, maybe that's the way to go. It's quick. You know, I mean, they say it's quick. You probably are like, oh, shit, I don't have a body. You know, that probably goes through your mind or something. I don't know. But that's one of my fears, kind of, at this point, dying in pain or having my loved ones die. You know, like my mom had a health scare a year ago in April, and it was just like, and now I'm just like, call her every, you know.
How is she with death, do you think, on a personal level?
I think she was scared. but she didn't want to show it. She was like, she was very, like, reassuring to everyone else, because everybody else was like, you know, a mess, and she was the one, like, you know, hey, you know, checking in with people while she's like dealing with this health scare. So that was really it was tough to watch, but I'm grateful she was that way. And then we talked about it later. So
yeah, that used to be my, actually, I knew of my mom's mortality before my own. And I can remember this so well because my mom was a single mom. She was a working mom. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we'd be home alone, which she, I feel like I have to talk to her because she'll probably listen to this. Like, I think it's a good thing she did that. It made us more independent. Like, I think she feels bad about it.
Maybe. Okay.
You know?
Yeah, me and my sister were latchkey kids.
Yeah. I think it's good, a little bit. You're not like kids who were with their parents all the time, I feel like got... are codependent people. Like, they can't be alone. So I'm grateful, but I would watch be up watching, you know, some show, and then the nightly news would come on, and it would say that thing like, it's 10 p.m., do you know where your children are? And I would always say to myself, I don't know where my mom is. Which sounds so sad. I'm sorry, I'm laughing. It was actually funny to me, you know, it was like a little reversal I was doing, obviously. But then my mind would kind of wander, and I would be like, I don't know where she is, she could be in danger, she could be dead. Like, I used to, yeah, kind of stay up, wait for her, make sure she was okay. And this is pre-cell phone, you know, so.
I had a similar thing. My parents are older, so my mom was 50, like upper 50s when other kids' moms are 30, and I was just like, well, then any day now. And I would like sneak into my mom's room while she was asleep, make sure she was breathing. It was along the lines of this fear of personal death, just like death, you know. And so I have been very aware of my parents' mortality. I think, like, living with my dad, for example, kind of makes me feel like, oh, you know, he's got some good years left, you know. I don't know, you know, hearing, oh, my dad is 70 years old, you know, people die at 70, people die in their 60s, you know, but seeing my dad and interacting with my dad, I don't feel like, oh, it's any day now, you know? But there's still kind of like that tingle in the back of my mind.
Yeah. It helped me a lot. I actually saw this movie. Any movie where the mom dies, I'm
every
gone.
Disney movie? Every single one?
Actually, because it's always... Okay, I should qualify it. Mom's dying of an illness. Because it's usually long and drawn out.
Yeah.
And there's a talk and crying. When it's like a... Because in Disney movies, it's always the very beginning.
Like, she
and she just...
Never
it's to me... You know, it's so funny you say that. Exactly. Like, it happens so fast. I feel like I didn't even... Like, Finding Nemo, for example.
Uh-huh.
That the mom dies,
didn't
right?
Even register.
I think I was like,
wasn't
oh,
she
just
did?
Disappears. In the very beginning, doesn't she kind of... But the way... Because the way she dies is like, they're all swimming together, and then she's gone.
Oh,
and
God.
Yeah, that's scary. But I must have been, like, grown enough to know that things die when I saw Finding Nemo. What? Yeah, but I was like, ah. Yeah, cartoons don't register the same. It's quite the same. Although I saw Big Hero 6. Have you seen that?
No.
So there, I mean, just on death, I was going through this whole thing then, and I had, you know, I was like, oh, Pixar. It'll be cool.
Up. Did you see Up?
Oh my God. Up, okay, yes.
And Toy Story.
See, that's a long drawn out death, and those people look like people.
Right.
So that's different too. Big Hero 6, they also look like people.
Okay, yeah.
But there's this scene where, so first of all, the kids, spoiler alert, the kid's brother dies the very, very beginning.
Okay.
The main character. That's really sad, and it stays pretty sad. But the really scary part for me was he realizes, like, in this portal he can go through that his brother might be in there or somebody he can save. And he's like, and they're like, you could die. Before he jumps in, he's like, I don't care. And he jumps through, and I was like, just like, what's going to happen now? Because he just goes through, and you're going to go with him, like, as the audience. And then okay. He just goes into this other, like, world, and it's all purple. And I was like, he's dead. It just freaked me out. I lost it. But, God, I got on such a big tangent. But I wanted to get back to, yeah, dying, death. All those fun subjects.
Something that I read.
Yeah.
Kind of quieted those voices a little bit for me. Was just like, you know, your consciousness before you were born, there was nothing. So logically, after you die, I don't think, you know, I don't believe in hell. I think that's bullshit. You know, it'll just be like, maybe you just remember the last day you had, and you know, or like it just won't be anything. Maybe
that, and that comforts you.
Be born, and you know, it'll just be. You could reincarnation could be a thing.
I am very into reincarnation.
You know, and it's easy to be into reincarnation.
It's very comforting, but it. You know, I was into reincarnation before this fear. Before I had this whole fear, I would just. Every now and then during the day, I remember, and I still do it, be like, this can't be the only life I've had.
You know?
Do you? Totally, you know what I mean?
Of course.
And especially, I have the slightest sense of deja vu every now and then.
Of course.
It's really eerie. It's really eerie when it happens, because it's like, this exact thing has happened. And then it kind of goes away really fast.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I was at a show once. And I was like, I've seen this before. I know this line. And then it was gone.
I feel like I have prophetic dreams sometimes. Like, my dreams sometimes come true. And believe it or not.
But do you, when it happens, are you like, I feel like I've dreamt this? Or you're certain?
I feel like on two occasions, I've been like, no, I dreamt about this 2 weeks ago. Like, I feel like it is my feeling that on at least two occasions I have recognized the fact that I am revisiting what is happening. Now, I've never won the lottery or anything like that. So, you know, take that as you will. But
see, those ideas to me are way more exciting and interesting than heaven.
Yeah.
Heaven sounds very vague to me. I honestly, like, can't really grasp what that could actually be like, you know what I mean?
Especially because of the things I like to do, you know?
Right.
Can you smoke weed in? I would say yes.
I mean, why not, right? Well, there's a funny thing I've heard that's like, if it's just this, but forever, you know, if it's just like feeling, seeing, touching, eating, that's bullshit, because it should be, like, on some other level of, yeah. It should be just, like, roller coasters or something.
I mean, okay, so here's another thing. If you get into, like, string theory, you know, all that stuff, we've got three dimensions here. What if you just, boom, up to the fourth dimension, bam, up to the fifth dimension? Because I read this thing, and this phenomenon of the outcome of a quantum event can be changed by measuring it or observing it. And that right there just proves that I can't even...
I mean, that's like basically the butterfly effect, right? Like, if you go back in time and see World War II, the future will be different, right? Is that what you mean, kind of?
That's not the butterfly effect. The butterfly effect is a butterfly flaps its wings in Wisconsin and ... there's a tsunami in Tokyo. So that's going forward in time. But what you're talking about is when you travel back in time and like kill Hitler, the future will be totally different, like in ways you could never have imagined it.
Even if you didn't, that's why I'm interested in that observing
part. Observing it. Oh, if you just
saw him and he saw you.
didn't say anything, then no.
Oh, no? Oh, okay, sorry.
You're just gonna, like, solve World War II by seeing it.
No, just that it would change things. Just observing the alternative. Mm. Or the... Well,
there's no way you could... I mean, if you went back in time, there's no way you could replicate exactly, you know...
Your existence in that past changes it.
Changes
That's
it. By law. But this is what I'm talking about. So, this is going to be like the rough and dirty explanation of this quantum thing, right? So you take photons of light, right? And you take a barrier, like a wall, and you cut slits in the barrier at equal distances, like 5 slits, right? And you shoot photons at the barrier one by one. And on the other end is a photosensitive whatever that registers when the light goes through the wall at the barrier, right? So when you run this test without measuring it, without observing it, light acts like a wave, right? And no, okay, it's like a wave, yeah. And the photons are registered evenly across the photosensitive measurement on the back, which means even though you're shooting particles of light, photons, through slits, you get an even wash of light on the other side, right? Mm-hmm. But if you measure it with a camera and you do the same exact thing, shooting the photons, what you will get is the photons will be concentrated behind the slits and they will act like particles. Wow. If you think about shooting balls through slits in a wall, they're gonna be concentrated where the openings are. Like particles, and it changes whether you watch it happen or not. That's like,
how do they know what happens when they're not watching?
You come back and read the photosensitive, which is kind of like watching it itself. So like, how would you even know if you were just shooting it and no photos, you know? So that right there gives me hope that, you know, when we die, let's say, we just go to something that we could never imagine, and maybe that is what allows me to kind of like forgive religious people, because it's just like, I believe in something that cannot be explained, so you must also, and this is the way you have like chosen to make it make sense to you.
Yes.
I really like that magic of science thing. And just the magic of reality. I mean, reality, somebody said this who's smarter than me, but reality is as absurd as afterlife. Life is as absurd as an afterlife. I mean, like, this is crazy. That this is working, that, like, we're not all crying or in chaos all the time. We're just insane. Like, it's crazy that all of this works.
I have thought about this too. Like, how aren't we all just kind of like running around in circles? Like, we've organized ourselves. Now it gets chaotic, but buildings get built, you know.
Babies are born.
Food gets made. Babies are born, you know.
It's working, yeah. Body, the human body also freaks me out that way. Like, Earth working and the human body working. It's unbelievable. It's a miracle.
Oh, yeah.
But to use that language is so loaded culturally, right?
Uh-huh.
That it's like, oh, so you do believe in miracles?
No,
okay, let me show you.
No,
yeah,
okay,
it's like,
wait.
Why can't we bond over like this? Is I am humbled and amazed and grateful like to this.
Right.
Let's all just acknowledge, like acknowledging that would be a bonding and non-divisive way.
No, because people say, well, my way explains it the best, and that is what I just...
Oh, that's the part of religion that I cannot... Actually, like, really every other part, ritual, having a book, like, like going to a place to meet. I mean, these are really basic things that everybody does. People who have jobs do that, right? Right. People who, like, we go to school. School is kind of like that. Like, they're very similar systems, mm-hmm. prisons too. But it's that part that's like, no, but if you do it this way, everything will go right. The other ways, wrong. And it's just so hard for me. It's so hard for me to believe because it's so obvious to me that it's like a way of creating war, a way of making people cooperate with war. Like,
this is why. Okay, so maybe I always have to like relabel my philosophy, my personal philosophy all the time. I was talking to my friend and I was just like, I'm just anti-religion. I'm just anti-religion.
So you're anti-theist.
Yes. Yes. I'm anti-theist because of, like, all the good that people say, oh, but what about whatever, I don't know, Christian charities or whatever. There's 10 times as much bad. Like, seriously. If you really want to, like, no one wants to tally it up because it's very easy to say, oh, you know, this religion preaches, you know, tolerance and love. We just, like, kill gays sometimes, you know. But that's just, like, or the thing when, okay, you hear about a devout sect of some mainstream religion doing something really crazy and messed up, and then it's so easy to say, oh, well, they're not Christian. Yes, they are. They are. And they did it because of this reason. And so, you know, if... So, religion, and I'll say like Abrahamic religions, as they are taught now, are not conducive to actual peace and harmony, and because it's all about who's right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like,
yeah. I think I hate this word, but like spirituality and mysticism are what religion at their core. All religions are at their core do unto others. As you would have, like, that is really basic, on a basic level. All religions share that. And I started to get into this with my dad recently. He was like, why can't all of these be seen equally? And he was like, well, the Jewish laws were that you could, like, die if you believed in Jesus and, or whatever. Some, the Jewish laws are wrong. We can't follow the Jewish laws. They're wrong. And I was like, but the Jews believe them, so it's okay. Like, they're not doing any bad. They're not doing anything wrong to other people. Like, why does it matter so much?
Because people feel that other people's salvation and soul, it has something to do with them. And this is the thing. This is why someone will tell you to go to church or take it upon themselves to express how much they're judging you for not believing what they believe, because they think that that it is their job to save other people. And that's when the conflict, because if religions preach, okay, do this, do that, you know, touch your forehead every Thursday, and if somebody else doesn't do it, then, you know, let them be. That's not what religion preaches. It preaches, and whoever doesn't do it is going to hell and might take you with them. So you need to make them do it. And that is just like, that's the annoying part. Because I wish I could just be like I said, I don't try to deconvert my observant friends, even though inside I'm like, what the hell? I don't, you know, because I have to practice what I preach. I don't want to be converted. So I don't want to be, I'm not out here proselytizing.
But no. You're lost, Kurt. Don't you understand?
Oh, I'm let me be lost.
And you don't know, so I have to tell you. I agree. I think it's so condescending the way people come at me, especially Black people. So, like, this is what one thing I thought was is really cool about what you're saying is there's, like, not a mutual respect for everyone, for mm-hmm. religious and non-religious. Like, religious people demand respect from people, right? You don't respect my religion, but you don't respect my non-religion, right? Like, respect my non-religion, and I, you know, where's the equality, where's the fairness? But, so this goes into something that I think is really important that we ignore. There's so, like, with the gay marriage debate, for example, which is over, yay. Stupid.
It's not over.
It's not over. It's not over at all.
We've put a pin in it, let's say.
But that whole argument, right, is why do you care? What does it matter to you, religious person, what this other person is doing?
Because it makes sense to someone.
It makes sense. Their logic, religious logic is, and certain religions, not all religions are this way, but a lot of them, right? My salvation relies upon the sanctity of
the people around me, the people I know. How much I contribute to saving of society.
So it doesn't, I mean, I don't believe that logic, but that is their logic. So to combat it with, why does it matter? It doesn't matter to you. That's not their logic. Their logic is not individual. They don't operate that way. So, like, the whole separation of church and state.
Well, it is when we talk about, like, premarital sex and, you know, things that Christians love. You know, things Christians, you know, eating pork. It's all a personal choice. You know, when we talk about shellfish and mixed fabrics, then everybody can make their own decisions.
Right.
This is the hypocrisy of it all because I used to work for DC government and it's like all black and very Christian. When you go to a workplace, it's like, and my friend told me this. She was like, are you going to like be yourself? And I'm like, that's a pause.
That's okay.
She's like, are you gonna, you know, be yourself?
What does that mean?
Just like, be myself. And that is a non-observant, agnostic, anti-theist who is gay. You know, am I going to be myself? And I learned quickly that that's a bad idea. Because all these Jesus-loving Christians would not accept me for being gay or being an anti-theist or anything like that. All these, you know, WWJD folks think that what Jesus would do was first judge you and then hate you and then try to convert you. That's not what Jesus would do. I don't think so. So, I have spent countless hours with people who think that Jesus will help them find their car keys, help them help their team win the Super Bowl, help their car start when the battery died, but not help somebody who was homeless. Help somebody eat, help somebody who's starving, help somebody who has been a victim of, you know, assault. I don't think there's any logic in the whole system, the way it's
There's no logic to faith, but I mean just on like an argument level, when people try to argue against religious based ideology in terms of like laws, you know, when it goes that way, it just doesn't make sense. Like, that's why these things have to be separate. Anyway, so, but that's interesting to me, like, talking about blackness and faith, I feel like I was talking to, so my friend and I have this whole thing where we make lists of people, black erasure, we call it. Okay. So just, like, anything that a black person, like, isn't typically thought of doing. So a black baker, it was basically everything. I mean, everything we can think of. But, like, somebody black who's into anime, somebody black who cuts down trees, like, everything.
Who grows mushrooms.
Yes! Like, yeah. Everything in our cultural imaginary. A black lumberjack, right? That is not a black person. What's the first thing you think of, right? In your image.
Paul Bunyan
or whatever, like a white dude with a beard and a flannel. That's the way it is, right? So, and black atheist is on that list. And there's two things that come to mind. Obama's inauguration speech. He's the first president to ever acknowledge atheists.
As being people. Oh, like, thanks, Obama.
I know, right? God, that's so sad that that's like a great thing he did. But
this
he did. He said,
this is
my
how long
I know.
Let me just tell you.
He sort of called out my friends who are the faith and the non-believers as well. Like,
and he probably got some.
Oh yeah.
For that.
Yeah.
Oh, you're calling these people.
Right. But then on the other side, there's a, I don't know if you know this comedian, W. Kamau Bell. Mm-hmm. He had that show, Totally Biased. So he had this thing, he has a theory that it's not in sync with Black history to be atheist, because slaves never would have made it had they not had God. Like, hope is so... Okay. Yeah, so I want to get your opinion about that. That theory, I think, is really interesting to me.
Okay, I've had this discussion with many people, my mom included, and it's this. What do you think the people who made these people slaves were reading on their way over to Africa and on their way back?
The Bible.
It's like, Black people who were enslaved in the Americas were given this Bible at first to control them. Our first experience with Christianity was to maintain control of us. And there are so many diverse viewpoints and verses in the Bible that it's easy to say, oh, you know, Christianity is what saved us from slavery. No, because the people who believe in slavery do it justified by what it says in the Bible. The Bible is pro-slavery. And the fact that Black people were only allowed to get together to go to church and pray to this God that was being instructed was sanctioning their enslavement doesn't speak to the goodness of Christianity. The fact that the only way that Black people were allowed to be humans is in the context of Christianity, I think it speaks poorly of Christianity, because it was Christians who were perpetuating the system in the first place. It wasn't atheists telling them, well, there's no God, so I can have slaves. No, it was Christians saying, God says you are a slave because you have black skin and I am your master because I have white skin. Look, it's right here in the Bible, okay? And so to say this thing about black people, old Christianity, whatever, I've heard this, black people owe their freedom to Christianity. No, we don't. We owe our enslavement to Christianity. And I'm going to need black people to start acknowledging that, okay? You don't have to agree with it, but please just acknowledge the truth that our first experience with Christianity was under the context of our enslavement and not our freedom, okay?
I want to, like, do a standing ovation. Because that's exactly, and I always hesitate to bring that up with black Christians that I know, because I feel... It's so unbelievably true to me.
It's like, how that, do you even think anything different?
Well, I just know they don't. I mean, obviously they don't, right? And these are smart people, right? Again, like, so my only thing is that they must think that whatever we believed in Africa, or wherever we came from,
was the reason why we were chosen for slavery?
Or is could be at its root a Christian-like faith, or like it transitioned. Well, I don't know. I don't know. But we do have to. Black people everywhere have to contend with faith. I think in a way that other people don't. Like what you're saying, like.
I think blackness is a spiritual experience.
Become conscious.
Of course. Like, listen. Like, do your own research. And the truth will, you know, your truth will reveal itself. But on the subject of spirituality, I think being black is a spiritual experience. Like, my blackness is so, like, it is a spiritual experience, you know? How do I put this? Like, I don't know. I feel very spiritual about my blackness in a way that doesn't, I don't think that relates to kind of like you were saying, black people have to kind of like deal with spirituality. It's because I think that
people
our culture and our history is based on the soul, right? So right. soul music, soul food, right. like we're built into our history and our culture is like connection to the body, connection to our things that are gut, our feelings, mm-hmm. our feelings. Mm-hmm. It's all about how do you feel? Feel good? Like, you know? I feel bad, you know, the blues, right? Like, feel good, soul, feel bad, blues. That's such an eloquent and perfect statement. I kind of want to, like, leave that conversation because it's so great to think of blackness as a spirituality. Because I totally agree with that, especially as a African-American literary scholar, whatever, a researcher.
Claim it.
I'm a scholar. A gentleman and a scholar. It is always a spiritual experience to read slave narratives, to read anything by black people, because there's so much feeling and in every single part of it, and it can't be separated from the what they're trying to, what Toni Morrison, what Du Bois, what all these people were always trying to do is affirm them, their identity, and build something beautiful out of it that was already there. They didn't even have to build it, but out of words and ideas rather than pyramids and what was already there.
Let me tell you a story. Okay, so I've had some crazy travels in my day now, but this also, okay, so I grew up in the church, and I grew up in South Carolina, in Charleston, South Carolina, most recently in the news, right? But I grew up hearing, like, when you think of, like, the Holy Ghost or the Spirit moving in a church, I can still be brought to tears in a church. You know, I'm not somebody who has thrown away my spirituality, you know? And my mom is a gospel singer, you know? I have been there, yeah. You know? I went to Morocco, and I went to something called a Layla, which is like a night, like a Sufic Islam night. It happens at night. I have done no research on this, okay. But like, I was taken, cool. Right? I was taken to this thing by the brother of one of the program mates. I was studying abroad, right? So he takes us here, and it's like, in Morocco, they have this music called Gnawa, which is the music of the people brought to and through Morocco via the transatlantic slave trade and the North African slave trade and all that. So this is black music. This is black people.
I mean, Morocco is in Africa. I think people forget that.
Right, right. Even Moroccans forget it. but I'm talking about these are, the roots are sub-Saharan Africa.
Okay.
They're not
okay.
Moroccan. Northern. And they're not Arab.
Okay.
They are sub-Saharan African people who have been in the condition of slavery, which I think, like, when you take someone's fundamental humanity away, spirituality is like, it's like a, you know, it's how someone can hold on to their humanity. It's a way to remind yourself when everything around you is telling you you're not a human, you can go inside and remember that. So we go, and it's like at night, it's like we get there at like 1 o'clock in the morning, and it's like just starting, right? So there's drums, there's these cymbals, you know, mm-hmm. And there's a young guy who is in the middle of the room, and he's playing an instrument that's like low, and it's like do 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 do. First of all, the second he struck that first note, this woman right next to me just fell out. She just fell out and started shaking on the floor. And as he sang, I felt like I was at church. I felt like I was at a Holy Ghost revival. I
I feel it like now. I was home then, and it was like, and that proved to me right there that whatever I had felt in the church, it didn't have anything to do with Christianity. It had something to do with like fundamentally, like blackness transcends religion. You know, here I am at like a sect of a religion that I have very little experience about, and I feel like I'm home. I felt like I could turn to the side and see my mom. Wow. Like I cried. And my program mate, who was also there, who was white, had no idea what was going on. She was like, what is wrong with you? And I just could not explain it. And I just, it was a feeling in my throat that I could feel that I, like, and so I feel like some people are, like, kind of selling themselves short, attributing it to this, like, kind of surface thing. Oh, it's white Jesus making you feel this way. No, it's, you know, there's a core there. Mm-hmm. And it's no coincidence, you know, that humanity started with blackness. Like, we are the distillate. Like, we are the seed of all the other things, you know? And so,
But that's another church, right? So if, you know, there's the church of science, there's the church of, if I tap three times every time I leave the house. No, there's all kinds of gods, right?
Of course.
I recently thought time is like one of my gods. Mm-hmm. Like we're all beholden to it. We have no control over it. But it does like lots of beautiful things, and we don't actually really know like how it works except in this one way. But there's all kinds of ways, and I feel like thinking of blackness as a church or as a god or as a spirituality is really interesting, and but also could, but it's just another way, right? Acknowledging that everybody's just kind of trying to figure out the same thing.
Of course, yeah.
Should just bring us all together, and we should just all. I don't know how I got so like. Positive. This podcast has made me a much more positive person.
I feel like at the beginning of the podcast, I was like, I don't believe in anything. And then now I'm like, it just transcends the universe.
Yeah.
I mean, this is how I really feel. It's very easy to be like, you know, because of all the negative that I have personally experienced in terms of religion and religious people and my own identity and trying to be myself and accept myself for who I am. I have that anger, you know?
But it's both, right? It's the way we feel, and it's the way society has built this thing to be. It's the way, it's the way we think a kind of pure truth could overwhelm us all, like, or overhaul all of it, right? We're all believing in this one way of being, ultimately. But then culture and society really fuck everything up, right? Because humans just really know how to make things bad.
Being terrible.
And good, right? And good. It's bad and good. I mean, part of my journey really is the negative and the positive. Like, how do you balance those things? Mm-hmm. Sometimes you can't, right? Sometimes the negative swallows you up. But ultimately, like, those are, like, the two warring things for me.
Yeah.
And I just always acknowledging that it's both, always. Everything, kind of. So, we're gonna... I want to just talk a little bit about... Do you feel like your work in comedy as a comedian is linked up to how you feel about blackness, how you feel about spirituality?
My motto on my little cards is Kurt Mariah, queer, black, funnier than you. Now, my queerness is... you know, a fundamental part of me. But the black is, it doesn't come first, it's in the center, because it is central to everything. And actually, since the Charleston shooting, my comedy, I've been watching a lot of, you know, a lot of Red Fox, Richard Pryor, my man, damn.
Pryor's so homophobic though, no?
I guess he kind of changes at a certain point.
Yeah, he has...
Eddie Murphy is way more, but...
Yes. Yes, but, Paul Mooney.
Oh, my God. Paul Mooney is one of the funniest people.
Yeah.
It makes me laugh in a way that I can't understand. That's... And so those people are kind of informing.
Yeah, George Carlin even. He's a white dude, but he's very political and very incisive, if that's the word. Yeah. Sometimes I use words I don't know the meaning of. It sounds like the right word.
It does.
So the set, the church night set, the theme of the set was white supremacist terrorism.
Yes! Just the fact that people are acknowledging, like, white supremacy as a thing. I'm not trying to say white supremacy is... Yay, white supremacy is terrorism, I'm trying to say.
I'm like,
No. Just, like, people in mainstream media using that term, to me, is like, yes, it is a thing, it's real. And it's not just... White privilege, I feel like, is a comfortable... White people are getting comfortable with using that way of saying, of thinking about it. But, no, let's call it what it is.
We've been gaslit. Like, seriously, here's what I tell people. Do you know who's just as uncomfortable talking about white supremacist terrorism as white people? Black people.
Victims of white supremacist terrorism?
These same people at my job who are, you know, Bible-thumping Christians, I remember I said something about... I can't even remember, really, but I think I, like, said the word white in reference to someone, and they were like, oh, you can't say that. It's just like, oh, yeah, mass is listening. They got us spooked. They have us scared to call its name. It's like Voldemort.
When you were in D.C. government, working in D.C. government?
D.C. government, all black people could not... even breach the subject of racism as it exists. Like, racism, I feel like they would not even acknowledge the fact that racism exists, because black people have been fed this bootstrap lie, you know, this, like, we should all get over it, and if we would just work harder and stop selling drugs or whatever, and, you know, we'd be just like white people. And you know, we believe it just as much as they do, you know?
And the important thing is, really, it's like, it's ultimately not, it's definitely about white people and black people and people of color, but it's also just about whiteness, right? Whiteness is praised, and, like, on a European level, on a global level, this is a color problem. Like,
it is.
And America has it bad.
Oh, God.
That's an important... Because we're so fucking violent. Like, it wouldn't be such a big... I mean, it would be a big deal. But I remember just being in Spain. It's positive racism over there. They're really just... They'll call me, like, negrita. You know, it wouldn't... They're fucking racist, but it's like...
But they're not going to hire you. I mean, like, the lie is that positive racism is across the... You know... You know what I'm saying?
The lie is that positive racism.
The lie is that the culture that calls you negrita in a loving way also would hire you at the same rate as a white person.
Right.
You know, unlike the culture that calls you nigger in a bad way will not hire, you know, it's like two different things. And these people, like, that's untrue also.
But what happened at the church night? Did something else happen?
Oh, I did the set, and, the feedback I got was interesting. The black people that I had planted in the audience were like, yo. Like, first of all, I think there was a lot of shock. Mm-hmm. Okay, because, like, I didn't mince words. I could tell you what I said. But I think there was a lot of shock. But it was funny. And it was new. It had just happened. The shooting in Charleston had just happened. And I don't think people... And it's very hard to take something like that and make a comedy set about it and accomplish my goal, which was naming, calling it what it was while still entertaining people. And so the response from the people who did the show was, oh my God, that was amazing. Because a lot of white people, for example, it's like they feel it. They feel something is wrong, but they don't have the words. A lot of people don't have the words. A lot of people, you know, just feel
bad,
but they don't. And so allowing them to laugh while recognizing what is going on is a relief to some people, you know?
And that's your job.
Right, as a comedian. It wasn't my job to go up there and make a sermon about white supremacist terrorism and, like, you know, as a comedian, it was my job to make people laugh. But I could not, in good conscience, go up to something called church night and not call it out. And so, as far as my art, my comedy, I have resolved, you know, starting actionably with that set to continue, you know, calling it out in front of black audiences as well as white audiences. Because the challenge in front of black audiences is sometimes the response is, oh, we don't want to, you know, like, we don't want to do all, you know, we just came to laugh. And it's just like, well, I'm trying to make you laugh, but there's a war out there in the streets, you know?
This is real.
Right?
Yeah.
And I'm not like, you know, I hope that my knowledge and activism will grow and develop. I'm not like, you know, the best comedian in the world, you know, so I'm still developing my comedy, but I feel that it's like, it's intertwined and I cannot separate it.
Right.
And again, like, comedy as another kind of church, right? Another kind of, all these words are just so loaded, church and miracle and spiritual, but it's another place. I think comedy is kind of my church. That's what gives me the most relief in the world, is watching like Dave Chappelle YouTube. I just feel amazing. I feel so much better. I feel lighter. And it's through truth, right? Like, through honesty. Real stuff is being said. Always.
Right. Yeah.
Real stuff. And yet I can't stop laughing. So, like, those two things, to me, that's the most ultimate spiritual experience, because it's bringing together this something devastating. Like, if Chappelle does a joke about Hurricane Katrina, mm-hmm. or some devastating thing, no, I don't think so. But I was just trying to think of something bad. Right, that is taking something. It's again just this balancing of the negative and the positive. There is something funny about that.
I mean, and that's everything. Been blackness, you know.
Laugh at my pain.
Laughing at slavery since they put the chains on. You know,
that's a coping mechanism,
right,
too.
Right, of course.
So, this has been so, so great. I just want to do a game for the end. And it's just rapid-fire questions. It doesn't make a lot of sense. Nonsense, right? Reality is nonsense. you can say... So some of them are this or that.
Okay.
You can say both or neither.
Okay.
Or one or the other.
All right. It's like the lightning round.
But some of them are real questions. All right. Rapid fire questions. I need like a intro.
Rapid fire.
Oh, I'm going to keep that. okay. Ready?
All right.
Biggest fear.
Biggest fear. It's not very rapid fire, but losing my talent in some way.
Fuzzy or spiky?
Fuzzy.
Canned tuna or sardines?
Sardines with mustard.
In the can, or you just put it on?
In the can, the mustard flavor ones.
Divine or holy?
Divine.
Tea or coffee?
Both.
Laugh or cry?
Laugh.
Train or plane? Decapitation. How likely? Decapitation.
Plane.
Best meal.
Ooh, I mean I have a lot of those, so
just one.
Best meal, jeez. With friends.
Go fishing or scuba diving?
Fishing.
Winter or summer?
Spring.
If you could go to any major city in the world, which one?
Charleston.
Is time an illusion?
Yes.
Reality or an alternate reality?
Alternate reality.
Cake or fudge?
Ugh, neither.
TV or music?
Music.
Die in your house or in a nursing home?
Die in my house.
Prank call or magic trick?
Magic trick.
Fire or thunder?
Fire.
Beer or wine?
Both.
Awesome. Thanks so much for doing this. We're done. Wait. Can you say, "That's so Raven"? It's like the tag.
That's so Raven.
Yay.